trip.
Who's with me?
Can you dig it?
We're on a mission from God.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Let's go.
Hey, I'm Brian Duffy.
And I'm Russell Davis.
And this is Road Rash. What is Road Rash? Road Rash is Russell Davis and Brian Duffy traveling around the world, something we've done for the last couple of years, so much so that people are dying to know what some of our experiences are. Two guys who literally live life to the fullest. You can't beat this. You can't get past this.
Guys, come out, eat, drink, travel with us. Every episode, including this week, we're going to have special guests.
Every Tuesday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard,
from a different location around the world.
Don't be a rash hole. Get your devices ready.
Come on out, all you rash holes, every Tuesday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard.
Hey, I'm Brian Duffy.
And I'm Russell Davis.
We're going to eat, drink, and travel. This is Road Rash. Road Rash number 4. Are you kidding me, Russell? We're on our 4th episode of Road Rash.
Number 4, brother.
Dude, this is crazy. I can't believe it. And we've had some really, really awesome guests on for the last couple of weeks. And I think that I don't want to use the word that we're going to top the last couple of guests, because I think that all of those people were absolutely amazing. I mean, we're talking about Danielle. We're talking about Alexis. We're talking about Eric and Brad and Nick and all those guys. I'm telling you what, though.
Warren. We literally have had some of the best guys possible.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that the one that I'm pretty stoked about is the fact that we have the a guy who I knew was going to be fun. Mm-hmm. I had a really good feeling he was going to be fun just from hearing from you and listening to Mike on all that stuff. But I think it was when he actually got onto the line with us and started talking to us that I kind of I had to sit back and smile a little while. And we're talking about – who are we talking about, Russell?
We are talking about 14-time World Series of Poker champion, Mr. Phil Hellmuth.
Mr. Phil Hellmuth, who was an absolute riot to have on. I mean, seriously, just to talk to and to listen. I mean, he's so energetic, and he is one of the nicest guys.
He might have cooler – or actually, he does have cooler stories than we do.
you started to say might. As I'm looking at his website right now, and the guy's standing in front of his private jet, I'm saying he does.
Yeah, and he's raised $40 million for charity in his life so far, and he's trying to raise $100 million. That's nuts.
His goal is $100 million for charity. That's all money that gets donated right back. So that's pretty impressive right there in itself, man. I'm stoked about that.
And
so,
he drinks mezcal.
And he drinks mezcal.
Yeah. God, I just love him, man.
Yeah, seriously. And he drinks Kemosabe mezcal, which is his new brand.
Yeah, that's his thing, man. That's his thing.
Now, does he own Kemosabe, or is he just talking about it because he likes the way it gets him drunk?
I think he likes the way it gets him drunk. Really? Makes him play better.
I got a feeling he's got something. He's got some stake in there somewhere.
Well, I hope so.
I mean, the guy's a gambler, for God's sakes. Why not gamble on some tequila? So, but yeah, he was good. He was good, fun, and he was a great guy to interview, and just really, really down to earth. And I don't know if I put enough plugs in there for the fact that I really want to get involved in one of his poker tournaments, as a celebrity poker tournaments. But when I finally sent him an email and that said, "I want to be a celebrity in your poker tournament," I think he got the point.
Well, you know, I got invited to the Kentucky Derby one, and fortunately I was too sick to make it, and then I got to do one in L.A., and luckily I made it to the last table in my round.
Really?
Yeah.
Who else was at your table?
Oh, man, I don't even remember. It was one of those that I didn't realize that they were all celebrities, because I was just kind of playing, and some of them were, you know, you're not really advertising who you are, and then you kind of walk away and everybody's like, "That's so and so."
Oh, really?
So, and you're just like, "Oh, man." Went out and smoked a cigarette, and it was Lou Diamond Phillips.
Oh, nice.
Smoked cigarettes, but I was playing poker this day. So,
dude, what La Bamba?
Yeah, La Bamba. La Bamba. Yeah.
Yeah, he was awesome in that movie.
Young Guns.
Man. Yeah, Young Guns. That's right.
Jeez, man, yeah, he was just a badass. And but the thing is that Phil is just an absolute, like, showman and just party thrower, that it was not just a poker tournament, it was just a fucking fun time, you know?
Yeah, he was. Yeah. That would be pretty awesome, dude. I'd love to get involved in one of those.
Oh, man. And he knows how to raise that money, you know? He got me back behind the bar to make a margarita for a couple, and they paid $5,000 for it.
Really?
Charity, so, yeah.
There you go, dude.
Yeah, he knows how to hustle.
The most expensive cocktail in the world. By Russell Davis. 5K. That's awesome, dude. That's awesome.
It was fun, dude. You got to come.
Good.
We got a road rash represented, these charity poker.
I'm ready to go, dude. You know I am. We're going to hop on a jet and get out there. You know, on our way to when we go to, well, we're in Reno. We're in Reno this week.
We are in Reno this week.
We are in Reno. Actually, we're recording this a little bit early, but we leave for Reno on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. We leave for Reno on Tuesday.
Yeah. While this is airing, you and I will be drinking.
Yeah, you and I will actually be on the air and we'll touch down and drinking in Reno for the first day together. And it'll be the first time that this is very meta, by the way.
Yeah.
We're talking to each other now a week before we'll actually see each other for the first time in a long time.
In a long time. Now, so what time do you land?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't even checked. I leave at 7:35 a.m. from L.A.
I didn't know you were Mr. Overachiever.
Oh man, I gotta go in there, and you know, I gotta trailblaze for you guys.
That's true.
There.
Yeah, I don't get in until I think I get there at like 3:45 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So just in time for some happy hour. Just in time.
And that's what the time change too. So you'll already be happy, a little happy houred out.
Yeah. Well, if I get my upgrade, if I don't get my upgrade, dude, then guess what? I'm not gonna drink on the plane. I'm gonna sleep. Upgrade, drink, downgrade, sleep. Bam. That's the way it works. Self-medicate, I call it. So,
I like that equation.
That's perfect. Absolutely, dude. Because if you're in first class, like, fuck it, man. I want to hang out. I want to talk to people. Last time I was in first class that I flew where I had great people with me, I sat next to Dikembe Mutombo.
Oh, I know. How do I know that name?
Because he's a basketball player who's like 7 feet tall.
Oh, yeah, that's me. Yeah, I'm like the guy that doesn't know anything about sports. Like, it's a musician, right?
Yeah, no, I'm the guy. I'm the other guy that doesn't know much about sports. But no, Dikembe Mutombo sat next to me, and he was such a riot because he was reading the Wall Street Journal. No, I'm sorry, he was reading a newspaper. I don't even know what it was. USA Today, and it's all colorful and all that stuff in there. And he was so funny because he was
reading a Road Rash comic book.
Exactly. He was reading a Road Rash comic book. and he was commenting on all the athletes that were in the magazine. And at one point they paired up a baseball player with a basketball player and their salary. And he literally looks over at me and he points and he's like smacking the paper. He goes, you see this? It means your career's over. When they start pairing you up against somebody else who plays in a completely different sport, it means your career's over. That's it. It's that simple. And I'm not shitting you, dude. 6 months later, the guy that he was talking about fucking retired.
Bam.
Retired. So that was it. But Dikembe Mutombo has he owns a hospital in Kenya.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's awesome.
I didn't know you could own a hospital. But apparently you can make so much money that you buy a hospital in your homeland. And that's what he did. So Dikembe Mutombo, rock and roll dude. And I gave you my number. You never called me. You told me that we were going to do something together. And we landed in New Orleans and I never saw you again.
You told Duffy that you guys are going to be best friends and hang out.
I did. I did get that. I got that warning in the mail about stop contacting him. You know.
Oh, that little. I got that little restraining order or whatever.
That's what it's called—a restraining order. I forgot the name of that. I totally forgot the name of that. Man. So, but
I think it's just a love note. He's playing hard to get.
I'm good with that. Yeah. No, don't egg me on. You can't egg me on. I already told you I got an order. You know.
You don't even watch basketball. He's just. Friendly dude.
I am. He's just a good guy, you know? I mean, I've got a picture, and I think my head was up to just below his chest. So it was the same flight that Anthony Bourdain was on.
Oh, man, that would have been my – see, I love Anthony Bourdain. He's a drinker. I mean, sorry, he's an eater that drinks, and I'm a drinker that eats, you know? So I just feel a kindred spirit with
him. Well, he was a drinker for a while who just ate a little bit.
Yeah,
he drank for a little while, and he was funny because I had walked over to him, and I'm not like fanboy in these cases. Like if I respect somebody, I'm going to go over and say something to him. Although I did meet J Lo once, many years ago, and I couldn't speak to her because she's just so fucking hot. But
J Lo was the one that you couldn't speak.
J Lo was the one, and there was one other. I'll remember her name in a minute, but I was like smitten, dude. Like I remember not like feeling like being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It was weird. Yeah. And I'm not that guy ever. Like, I'm a pretty confident dude. And the way that I live my life and run around, I'm a pretty confident dude. No, I was like a little boy.
That'd be Bon Jovi for me. Bon Jovi.
Really?
I'd freak the fuck out, man.
Really?
Freak the fuck out.
Bon Jovi is your, like, silence guy? Like, that's the guy who'll shut you up?
That guy or... Yeah. I mean, Tom Cruise for a while, but I don't know how to feel about that anymore.
Yeah. I think, you know, yeah.
Yeah, man. Yeah, yeah. I would just freak the fuck out. Or Robert Downey Jr. And I've mentioned
okay.
him on the podcast before.
You know, but I think that the Robert Downey Jr. thing, yes, and you have mentioned him before. I got a feeling he'd be a good dude.
Oh man, a great dude. And I would just I can't say this enough. I would just sit there and beg him to be my best friend.
Yeah. Beg him. Great. Do you want my lawyer?
I think I'm going to need that.
He can walk you through the process of making sure he becomes your best friend, or at least the legal avenues.
You know, I actually had a friend of mine that Robert Downey Jr. styled an arrest. I'm not going to mention his name, but we were in New Orleans, you know, Tells the Cocktails every summer in July. Tells the Cocktails, this giant cocktail convention, and it's one of the most respected in the industry. And so me and a bunch of guys and girls, we used to call ourselves the Golden Eagles, but we were, you know, a mix of brand ambassadors. Some of them worked for liquor companies, distillers, mixologists, bartenders, you know, and we would all get this house together. Well, one day my buddy didn't come. We all went out partying and we just lost him in the middle of the night at this old Absinthe House, which is a really cool bar that everybody meets up at one night in the middle of the night during Tales. And, well, the next morning he comes in and he had been arrested because he had walked to what he thought was our house, walked to someone else's house in New Orleans.
Oh, no.
Walked in, took off his clothes, crawled into a bed, and went to sleep, and it wasn't his, it wasn't our house.
Okay. All right. We got to talk. I was 21 years old. And I was playing rugby for Second City Rugby Troop out of Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. And we went down to the Rugger Fest. No, we went down to the Sevens tournament that was down in Dewey Beach, Delaware. And so we all go out. It's a crazy shit show night. It's total rugby weekend. Everybody's down there. It's absolute insanity. There's ruggers everywhere you look. So I come home that night, and I'm with one of my buddies. And we walk up, and there's two doors. There's four doors, one upstairs, two upstairs, two downstairs. Pick up the phone, and I'm in fucking Delaware. And I start calling my girlfriend at the time, and her name was Amy. It doesn't matter what her last name is. Her name was Amy. And Amy was a really, really cool chick, man. She was a really, really cool chick. And I call her, and we're on the phone, and I sit on the floor, and I start talking. And then I hear, excuse me, excuse me. And I literally turn around. I'm like, I'm on the phone. I'll be off in a minute. And the girl's like, excuse me, you're in my bedroom. And she keeps saying, like, who are you and what are you doing? And I kept yelling back. And I'm like, I'm friends with McMullen. Don't worry. Like, I'm friends with McMullen. And she's like, I don't know who he is. And I'm like, this is his house. He owns, this is his house. And she's like, this is my parents' house. Like, you're in the wrong house. And I'm like, no, this is where McMullen lives. And she finally was like, she stands up and like starts screaming at me to get out of the house. So I'm like drunk as a skunk. I still have a beer bottle in my hand. I walk in the living room. I'm like, Turtle, dude, we're in the wrong fucking house, man. We got to go. So the worst part is we were in the house upstairs. We needed to be at the house downstairs. I go to open the door to walk in downstairs after almost getting arrested by the chick upstairs who was going to call the cops. And I go to open the door, and I can't open the door all the way because there's like 40 fucking rugby players all laid out on the floor. So I went from believing that my buddy was going to sleep on a couch, I was going to sleep in a bed, to me having to sleep in front of the door with 40 other guys on the floor. So
bam.
That's my story of walking in the wrong house.
Well, you know what's funny about it is in our industry, there's always a fucking John so-and-so.
Yes, there is.
Yeah. Always a John so and so, and he's always anonymous. So whether or not we have the John so and so as a friend, or they know John so and so trying to get in the door, or you as the chef, they know John so and so.
Yep, yep. Everybody knows him.
Yeah,
everybody's got a John
so and so.
Yeah, especially when it comes to that. Like I was sitting on the floor, man. I was on the phone. I was having fun.
I love these stereotypes of characters that we're like bringing out in the bar industry. We've got Bob the Enforcer, John So and So, Shane NDA,
yeah,
Pelly Rojas,
Shane NDA, dude, that's
Shane
the best.
Shane NDA,
that's the best.
Shane DA, excuse me.
Shane DA.
Should be Shane NDA or Shane DA?
Shane DA.
Shane DA.
Yeah, I like that. I talked to Shane last night, man. I talked to Shane for a half hour last night.
Yeah, how's our favorite executive VIP,
dude,
Las Vegas man?
He is so ready for us to get to Vegas. It's unbelievable.
Oh, God.
Yeah, he's ready. He was pretty funny. We talked for a while. We talked about some of the guests that are coming out. We've got Carla Pellegrino.
Yeah.
Who's the chef. Yeah, she's a little celebrity chef. She's a beautiful, beautiful woman, dude.
Yeah.
I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. I'm really excited to talk to her.
I don't know. That's absolutely, that's just amazing, actually. We're going to need to hire a nurse and get, like, IVs the next day just for the hangover.
Yeah.
Like, just pump us up.
Dude, I think we should have Carla on the show before we do the live thing in Vegas with her.
What's that?
I think we should have Chef Pellegrino, Carla, on the show with us before she gets to Vegas.
Yeah, I mean, however we can get her on.
Dude, she's got a lot of restaurants, man.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah, she's awesome.
Britalian. Brazilian Italian food, dude. Neapolitan Cantina.
I mean, I'm really excited about the nightclub and bar show this year. You know, this is gonna be fun.
Oh, so am I, dude. We're gonna have a blast. I'm doing a bunch of classes, and we're doing a forum together, and so I know. Well, Shane asked if we can go in on Saturday because he wants us to do some NASCAR with him on Sunday.
Oh, some NASCAR.
Yeah, he's got his big RV down there. His big recreational vehicle.
His big recreational vehicle.
He does, and he said we could crash in the recreational vehicle.
That's dangerous.
Yes, if
that's not the way to start out Vegas.
I know, and that's what I told him. I said, I don't know if I want to start that day because I've got to work the next day. I've got to be responsible the next morning. I've got a class that I have to teach, that I have to be a seminar for.
Yeah. Not passed out in the parking lot.
Not passed out in the parking lot. Nope. No, not at all. But he did ask if we go down, and one of the reasons was he wanted me to do barbecue with a whole bunch of wounded warriors.
Oh, that's cool.
Which he knows is like a sweet spot for me.
Yeah.
I love my military, man. I think it's because I never joined the military, and I should have. I believe, but I think I would have had a different world if I joined the military.
Yeah, there was a moment where I considered applying to Naval Academy in West Point in high school because my grandfather came from a long line of military men. But yeah,
really,
yeah, my grandfather was one of the first Navy SEALs. It was back when they were called Frogmen, UDT, underwater demolitions.
There you go, dude. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
That's pretty
back
cool.
In the day, the Dizzo. I didn't know any of this about him until after he died, though. We just knew he was a naval captain, and then after he died, all this stuff kind of came out.
Everybody started talking.
Everybody started talking.
I was in Guam 2 years ago, and so I do a lot of, I don't know if you know or not, but I do a tremendous amount of work with the military whenever I can.
Mm-hmm.
I have clients that are military from Guantanamo Bay up into Great Lakes Naval Station to I work for a group called the Mess Lords, which I would love to have some of the Mess Lords on sometime because these are guys that I've traveled the world with who have travel stories unlike anything else. Stretch Ruminer is one of them who I drank.
Stretch is just a great guy.
Stretch is a great, you know, Stretch. I forgot you know.
Oh, yeah,
Stretch.
We called FaceTimed you from help. Yes. I went and did an appearance over open up for Grinders in Leavenworth.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, in Leavenworth. I love it. Yeah, that's Stretch. Well, I watched Stretch cool break spot. His finger on a 3,000-year-old street in the middle of Rota, Spain.
Sounds like Stretch.
Because he was trying to ride a unicycle. And just so you know, it was a cobblestone street. So put Stretch, who just so everybody knows, Stretch is like 5'4". He's not stretched really at all, except for his hair. Put a tremendous amount of Jack Daniels, and a unicycle, which I respectfully, affectionately was calling a unicorn for the rest of the trip because I couldn't get unicycle out during my drunken stupor. But the best part about it, Russell, is that I have a picture of Russ of Stretch falling off of the unicycle because I was taking a selfie with a pint of Guinness in my hand in Spain. So I have the actual evidence of Russell of Stretch breaking his hand. It was good. It was really good. It worked out perfectly.
Stretch has got some good stories too. You know, he was in Guar, that band Guar. Remember them?
Crazy ones? Yeah. No, I know. Stretch is a character in himself.
We got to have him on the show.
Okay, cool. So we got Stretch. Great. Somebody take a note. Where's our admin? Mike? He's not on yet.
Okay, so I came across a little article this morning that I wanted to bring up because it touches base on what we brought up in a couple weeks ago on the restaurants getting rid of their tipping policies. So on CNN Money, so money.cnn.com, there's an article that has just come out that it's titled, "This Restaurant Killed Tipping and Now It's Bringing It Back." by a lady named Catherine Vassell. Now, what's interesting about this is that they're talking about one of my buddy spots, Thad Vogler, who I he's based out of San Francisco, and he does some really, really great spots, particularly Bar Agricole and Trou Nauman. And the interesting part about it is that Bergerac, one of the bars that I opened years ago, was right across from Bar Agricole, so I know this area very, very well. And so basically what happened at the end of the day is they went with the no tipping policies back in October ish and got their staff on board with it and ended up doing away with it just recently because the staffs were becoming very not unhappy with their job and high turnover rate was starting to happen and they were spending so much money on retraining and doing everything. Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. And this is one of the most respected men in the bar industry. And so it's very interesting that he would come out and very much speak about how this wasn't the way for them to go. And Bar Agricole is one of the best restaurants in San Francisco. So this is really cool. You know, to me, it just kind of proves, you know, a little, not want to pat ourselves on the back, Duffy, but I think we're right on this situation.
Well, I mean, dude, so I would love to know how many people left within the first couple of weeks, how many people really wanted to give it a shot, and then to see what would happen.
You know, from what I'm coming from the article is that they, you know, they really got the staff on board. And the way that Thad has his staff and knowing the staff that they had, you know, I pretty much think that that's the way it was. These guys, if Thad's on board with it, the staff's going to go in line. So I have no doubt on my mind that a lot of the staff was on board and wanted to try this new thing. So, you know, I don't think there was any kind of like backlash from the beginning on that, where you're having to deal with people that don't want to do something.
Right.
But I think they genuinely tried it. And, you know, one of the things that the numbers they're pulling up is they said when tips were allowed, servers at the two restaurants made $35-$45 an hour, which fell to $20 to $35 when critique was eliminated. I mean, you're talking about a 40 to 50%. I mean, it's literally cutting some of these, almost cutting these salary or these tips in half, their ability to make money.
Yeah, that's big, dude.
That's huge.
Yeah, that's massive. Well, but I wonder what the outcome would be if it were a national thing where it just literally went across, because at that point, then those employees don't have an opportunity to go somewhere else to do the tipping part. You know, so I wonder what would happen in that case. I mean, I know I see it now, whereas, I mean, we all know how it happens. Look, you open a new restaurant and there's 40 people that are dying to work in that place. Within the first 2 weeks of opening, you've got, you know, 35 or 30 people that are dying to work there. Then the next couple of weeks, you've got 20 people that are dying to work there. You know, yeah. And these people are leaving because they're making all their money. I mean, I know career servers who just open restaurants. Yeah. You know, anytime that there's a restaurant that's opening, they are going and working in that place. And the funny part is that they're good enough to go back to the places that they've left. So they'll go in, they'll go through a training process of making that $10 or $12 an hour that they make during the training process. And then they'll leave that, you know, and then they go into that tip phase for that first 3 weeks, that month of honeymoon period. They make all the cash that they can. And then guess what? They're going right back to Bob's Bar and Grill, you know, that's owned by Bob the Enforcer. It's off the books. It's off the books. So don't ask.
He just has a small percentage in it.
Yeah, that's just a little percentage of it. Yeah. So well, that's cool though, man.
For somebody back in the day,
I'd love to know what I want to keep following this. I really want to keep seeing what's happening because there's a lot of places out there that are making the discussion. I mean, like I said, I have clients right now that are looking to, you know, the owner of the company wants to be aggressive and eliminate the tipping with inside of the restaurant in one of our properties. And I mean, I'm highly discouraging them from that. I don't think that that's the way it is, especially in a transient area where we're getting ready to open. But I don't know. We're going to see what happens, man.
Well, you know, I think that this is just proof positive that in status quo, this system of non-tipping creates disgruntled workers and costs the business more money in turnover and training.
Absolutely.
Period.
Yeah. Period. And it's proven. They just showed it. So there, it's a scientific fact now. Done. Fucking done, dude.
It's a road rash scientific fact.
Exactly. It's a scientific fact. You tried it. It didn't work. We win. That's it. There's nothing else to say about that. You know? Damn. We got that. All right. Man. So I want to talk about something real quick before we get into – before we start talking to our guests here. I'm reading Nation's Restaurant News, which I'm a huge fan of. It's an online magazine now. For anybody who doesn't have it, you can all just go and check in and check it out. You have to log in if you want to get like really deep into some of the bigger interviews. You have to become a member of it. But here's an article that's on the head of the page, and it literally, Chipotle CEO is extremely confident that the food safety crisis is over. Okay, so the change push to invite customers back is now scheduled for mid-February. So this just came out about 4 days ago.
Wait, so can you repeat that one more time?
So Chipotle CEO is now extremely confident that the food safety crisis is over, which I don't know if you know, but a couple months ago,
the shit that they've been going through.
Yes, big time. But it's one of the things that I really try to talk about because, you know, I have so many people who are so aggressive in their – so many of my clients are very aggressive. They want to open their third, their fourth, their second, whatever it is, properties. And I say to a lot of people, we have so many things that we have to take care of first. You know, we want to make sure that we're financially stable, one. Two, we want to make sure we're organized. We want to make sure that we have the right people in the right place. I also want to make sure that we have the right menus in place. I want to make sure I have the right plates in place. I don't want to have to be piecing restaurants together when we go to open them. But it's funny how secondary it is when it comes to the food safety part of it.
Yeah, and so if you don't mind, like, just explaining exactly, because I know about it, but I know some people out there don't necessarily. What exactly were they going through?
So in December, Chipotle was subpoenaed by federal investigators in a criminal probe, which was tied to the neurovirus outbreak in Simi Valley, California. So the outbreak, a whole bunch of people got really sick, is basically what happened. Okay, so a bunch of people were eating it at Chipotle. Let me find this out real quick. Hold on, Chipotle, how many people got sick? Outbreak. I don't know if you remember, and Russell, you may be a little bit younger. I mean, you are younger than me, but in the early 80s, there was Jack in the Box.
There is still Jack in the Box.
There is, but it's but you ready for this? It's only on the West Coast.
Oh, you're talking about when the kid died
from poisoning. Because of the E. coli or salmonella. That was the big thing. So in this case, and they shut down on the East Coast, man. I mean, they ripped it apart so bad. Yeah. I mean, I remember hearing about this. Like, a kid died. Yeah. And they ripped them apart so bad that they shut down their East Coast operations. Like, I've never seen a Jack in the Box on the East Coast. Yeah. I've seen him on the West Coast, and I kind of laughed, but I'm like, I'm not eating fucking Jack in the Box.
That was about the same time where the lady was being handed the McDonald's hot coffee and spilled on her and got burned.
That was about 10 years later.
Okay.
The McDonald's thing was about 10 years later, yeah. But this was literally, they were, like, a kid ate there, got sick as shit, a bunch of other people got sick, and they shut them down. So yeah. So here we have the Chipotle.
God, and I love their egg rolls.
Dude, I've never had any of their stuff.
Oh, Jack in the Box has the best egg rolls.
I've never had a Jack in the Box.
I know, it's so weird.
Yeah, I've had an Ace in the Hole, but not a Jack in the Box. So, okay, so here we have the Chipotle E. coli outbreak spreads to 6 states. Okay, 45 people in 6 different states have contracted food poisoning after eating at a Chipotle restaurant this fall. Most cases, meaning 26 of them, were in Washington State. The CDC also reported 2 cases in California, 2 in Minnesota, 2 in New York, 1 in Ohio, and 13 in Oregon. At least 16 people have been hospitalized, okay? So the outbreak occurred between October 19th and November 8th, but the number might continue to grow. They're saying that new cases actually have occurred after – or that new cases that occurred after October 31st are still possible for this. But it's just funny that we think about it now. Now, think about it in the 80s when this happened with Jack in the Box. They shut them the fuck down, dude. They shut them down.
Yeah.
You killed somebody and somebody got sick. You're done here. We don't want you here. We want you out of here. Now, Chipotle, which is a $1 billion company, a multi-billion-dollar company, okay?
Started out of Austin, I think it was Texas, Austin, right?
Were they?
Possibly. Don't quote me on that one.
No.
Let me interrupt you.
And it doesn't say, but it's just funny that now in this day and age, when we're so aware of everything that we're doing, how nothing major's happened to them. Now, they got fined and all the other stuff, and that's good, but it's such a convenience. And people love their product so much that it's almost like it went away. It went away.
Yeah. It's you know, disturbing. Is that because we don't value it as much, or, you know, I mean, I feel like we're humanity's heading towards a cleaner lifestyle. You know, why is that happening there?
Well, I mean, this, you know, they're saying that the stuff came in from the chicken and the way that it was handled. It's not the first run. Here's the weird part. This is not the first run-in with foodborne illness for these guys. They're already facing lawsuits from two recent incidents in August. More than 100 people at a Chipotle in Simi Valley, California, contracted a neurovirus, often called the stomach flu, in that same month. 45 people in Minnesota got sick from salmonella-tainted tomatoes, traced to 22 different Chipotle locations. In the most recent outbreak, the company closed more than 40 locations in Oregon and Washington, which have since reopened. It has not yet been determined what the source of the E. coli is. Come on, man. How is this? How are they still open is my question. Yeah, gotten all of these people sick. And the funny part about it is, you know, I always talk about less items on your menu, the less opportunity there is for spoilage, the less opportunity there is for waste, the less opportunity there is for theft and stuff like that. So it's kind of funny because their menu is very limited. It's very simple.
It's all right. I like Freebirds more anyway.
I've never been to a Freebird. Where the hell's a Freebird?
Man, that's a Texas thing, but I think they're expanding. You know, Freebirds for life. Freebirds for life. So, yeah.
So we need to discuss, not right now, but at some point we have to discuss. I want to do a show in Texas, man. I want to go to, like, your hometown.
You want to go to my hometown?
I do. Maybe not your hometown, because there's only, like, 22 of you guys.
It'd actually be almost more fun to go to Austin, Texas.
Well, no, I'm fine with that. I'm totally cool. Austin, Texas, it's time for you
Austin
to represent.
Austin is what I really consider my hometown. You know?
Okay.
That's the spot that I'm just like, I spent so much time there. That's with my friends. It's not, you know, everybody I consider family's right out there. It's just
you know what would be fun?
Amazing.
To do like a tour of places that we've worked. To actually go back to some of those places and speak to like employees.
Why don't we should bring on some of our old, the person that gave us our big break. We should do something where I interview the person that gave you your big break, what they saw in you, and you interview my person.
See, I'm weird, dude. I'm weird in the fact that I didn't have anybody who gave me like a big break.
Well, you know, it was Eric Cash who gave me my big break, but the first person that promoted me to bartending.
Okay, I gotcha. Yeah, I mean, I was a dick, dude. I was aggressive as shit, man.
Yeah. Or my bar trainer. Yeah.
See, I was super aggressive. Although, you know, Tony Clark I worked under at the Four Seasons, and he was a really good guy. And he was, you know, this is a guy who I always talk about who threw shallots at the back of my head and did all that sort of stuff. So he used to yell at me, be like, that's not any shallot you're peeling. That's a fucking Four Seasons shallot. And he used to like scream at me. And it's funny because I was at a meeting at a culinary school a couple weeks ago, and they were discussing getting rid of the apprenticeship, which how crazy is that?
Yeah.
I mean, that's like a huge part of your training, man. You're not in front of an instructor. You're working with a real chef.
I'd have to bring in Jason Schell. Jason Schell he taught me how to blow fire. He promoted me throughout the ranks from security to bar back to bar.
You broke up Russell right after he said he taught you how to blow. He taught you how to blow what?
Oh,
what was that? I missed. I'm just fucking with you, dude.
I know you did. Yeah. You almost had me there too.
I had to take that opportunity and run with it, dude. I wasn't gonna let it go. I wasn't.
Yeah, yeah. Jason had a thing called the shellbo. So whenever he went into a fight, he'd use a shellbo first.
What's a shellbo? Oh, a shellbo. Oh, I love it, dude.
Yeah, I'd have to bring him on. That's it. That's my guy. Yeah.
Okay, I like it. I guess we probably have to do Tony Clark. I think that would really be the guy. I think he'd have to be the guy who really, because he was the guy that I went to when I was like, I was just talking to my ex-girlfriend about this the other night. We were talking, and I was talking about how when I was in the Four Seasons and I wanted to get on the line, and I walked in, I'm like, I'm ready to go. I want to get on the line. He's like, you can't handle the fucking line, dude. You can't handle the line. And I'm like, I want to get on the line because I don't know if you know Russ or not, but before I went into culinary school, I never really cooked in a kitchen.
Yeah.
So I literally learned what I learned while I was in school, the techniques and stuff like that. Now, I honed them as I left after all that, but it's not like I worked for somebody for 3 or 4 years and then went to school or then got in the business. I literally worked, you know, I learned what I was doing. So Tony Clark says to me, you can't handle the fucking line, dude. You're not ready for it. And I'm like, I can do this. He put me on there on a Friday night working with these guys, and I almost fell the fuck over, dude.
Yeah.
Watch. And he put me on a fish station. Now, the funny part, I was an apprentice still, so even though I was on the line with these guys, with the pros, I had to do all my shit. I used to have to wash their knives at the end of the night and then cryovac them. Yeah.
Awesome.
But you can't do that anymore because you get in fucking trouble from somebody because it's unusual punishment, whatever it is, you know? It's crazy. You can't smack them with towels. You can't call them a pussy on the line because they're going to call their fucking lawyer. So pussy.
Can't light the back of your barback's heels on fire with 51.
The best. No. Oh, the best, dude. When they have the really old frayed towels and you grab your little stove lighter, your long stove lighter, and he's like leaning against the counter and you light the towel on fire. Yeah.
We used to send our little new guys or bar backs or anybody who was green, especially if you get this done on the first day, because of course, you know, you worked in the big bar districts and you knew all the other bar managers around. And so you'd make up some fake thing that didn't really exist. And you'd tell the bar back, hey, go over to so-and-so over at this bar and ask them for banana juice. You know?
Yeah. Oh, dude, we had left-handed spatulas.
Yeah, left-handed spatula. The carbonator discombobulator, you know? And like...
The what?
The carbonator discombobulator.
Oh, dude, we had the bucket of steam.
Yeah, the buckets of steam. Yeah, and then like you knew the bar. My buddies would always know if the person came and asked for some fucked up shit that, you know, oh, well, we're out of it, but do you want a shot? And so they buy him a shot, and then they would send him over to another bar. So if you got this really rolling, you could have this guy running to five or six bars before he came back to you drunk. And then Dint was like, I don't have it. And then you'd be like, are you drunk? And you didn't bring back what I needed.
Dude, it's like when you told them, and I know everybody's laughing at us. Everybody in the industry is laughing at us because these are the old school war stories. But it's like when you tell the new busboy that he's got to empty all the hot water out of the coffee machine. And he goes over and just fucking sits
and it's
there.
It's hard lined in.
And it's all hardwired in, man. He's ready to rock and roll. He's just standing there with 5-gallon buckets, just dumping them down the drain. Yeah.
Oh yep. Man. Okay. So we need to do a rant sometime of just old school war stories.
Oh, absolutely, dude. Absolutely, just old school stories. All right. Cool. So
actually, that's when we need to pair it up with the guys that we bring in that train.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dude, I think that we should do that stuff. Like I said, I want my mother on the show.
Yeah.
Now we can't curse.
I want your mother on the show too,
dude. This is my mother I remember my good Irish Catholic mother who's a true rock star. She's just an amazing woman who dealt with three boys and a girl, and she's a really cool chick. But this is the woman who came outside one night when we had a whole bunch of people over and we were playing asshole on the back table, and we're like, Mom, you should come and join. My mother, who has like a glass of champagne a year and is still drunk 3 months later. Okay, man. The woman just doesn't drink. So she sits down to play with us, and she said, fine, I'm going to play, but I'm not going to drink, and we're not calling it asshole. We're going to call it jerk. So we played jerk for about 45 minutes with my mother, and anybody who said asshole, they had to drink while that time frame happened. So, yeah, my mother's a cool chick, man.